Coming up today, we speak to the man in charge of Hong Kong's paper of record, the South China Morning Post. Plus, we hear from an influential figure in Brazilian media and the editor of a beautiful annual literary title. That's ahead this week on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, with me, Tom Edwards. Brazilian media and a frankly adorable literary journal next. But we start the show in Hong Kong. The South China Morning Post is celebrating its 115th anniversary this year. The news organisation has been undergoing some freshening up since 36-year-old CEO Gary Liu got on board 2 years ago. Not from a traditional journalistic background, the American-born Taiwanese comes from Silicon Valley, with stints at Google, Spotify, and a Harvard degree in economics. Liu's tech background certainly stacks up for Chinese tech giant Alibaba, which hired him shortly after becoming the proprietor of the Post. Thanks to Alibaba's investment, the Post was able to move to new offices at the heart of the city, develop new branding, and recruit dozens of journalists, and more importantly, to adopt a new editorial direction. Our associate bureau chief in Hong Kong, Kurt Lin, went to have a chat with Gary Liu to explore what he's achieved and to hear about some of his future plans.
There's been a lot of change. I think that the primary change at the company has been cultural. And it has been a very real focus of the executive team because we believe that cultural change needs to come first for any other type of transformation to be successful. So there has been a change in our overall cultural language and in the company understanding how to work together as one. But also how to relate to our customers and our audience. Internally, it means that there's increased transparency in communication. There's a lot more focus on people, on personnel, on celebration. And of course, there has been a move towards agility, right? Towards an operating structure, operating cadence, and just all the tools and the personnel necessary to move fast and react to a changing environment in the news and media business. That's been the biggest change. I think if you had visited the South China Morning Post 3-4 years ago versus today, is that it feels like a different company, even though much of the personnel is the same. The people are the same. They may have been trained in new skills, but they've adapted to a new way of working and to a new relationship with one another and to our audience.
If you give a specific example of to define a culture, what would you say?
Let me pick at two things that I mentioned. One example of transparency, one example of celebration. For transparency, the company now, we hold monthly town halls. And this is a meeting for everyone in the company and those who cannot make it in person. We record the entire thing and we distribute it through intranet so that you can watch it later on. And in these monthly town halls, either myself or my chief operating officer will host other leaders, and we are fully transparent about where we're headed as a company and how we've been performing. So we will talk about our quarterly goals, and we will assess our performance from the previous quarter. And if we failed, we will talk about why we failed and how we're going to fix that problem for the future. That level of transparency, I think, is relatively new to the organization, but it helps different departments and a lot of different people doing many, many different things to actually be able to pull towards singular direction. It builds a different level of trust between our frontline employees and our executives. It breaks down this ivory tower idea of senior leaders sitting on an executive floor by themselves, coming up with plans and never really truly telling the rest of the company what's going on. And so all of that has changed. So I'm very, very happy with the level of transparency of communication, especially from leadership down, but at the same time now, the culture has also changed so that employees feel very confident in expressing their own opinions, in telling leadership their own ideas, and in demanding change in areas that maybe us as executives were not really aware of within the company. Mm-hmm. So town hall is an example of cultural change for the sake of transparency. When it comes to celebration, I think that as a news organization, because it is a daily business, because it never stops. You know, Monday through Sunday, there's always news, and especially today in a 24/7 news cycle. We never carve out enough time to take note of what we've accomplished, to acknowledge each other, and to really just have some fun and celebrate milestones. At the organization over the last year, year and a half, we've put a lot of effort into it. So a great example of it was just a couple of weeks ago when South China Morning Post celebrated our 115-year anniversary. And the birthday party, which was on a Tuesday, was a full day of events that was organized actually by employees. It wasn't the executives who said, hey, we're mandating celebration. That doesn't work like that. But very organically, we had a lot of leaders across the company organize events that not only rooted us back and reminded us of our incredible history as an organization, but pointed us forward to the opportunities that are ahead of us. And it was extremely joyful, and there were a lot of diverse opinions and diverse parties and events. And that's the kind of vibrancy that we want in our organization, and that's actually part of our value system here. So celebrating each other's great work and celebrating the opportunities of the future increasingly will be important for us.
Yeah. So I think you have mentioned a few big accomplishments since you have taken the job. And what about the areas that you're still working on? What are the things that, because changing the culture of a big flagship is a long journey, I presume. And so what are the areas you're still working on?
We are still working on everything. Even the culture change, it's not complete, right? We're not at the end of cultural transformation. In fact, I still think we're at the very, very start of it. So I would say that we've made a lot of progress in the last 2 years. We've initiated a lot of new things, but there is no success that we want to talk about yet, because 2 years is a very short amount of time in this transformation journey. The reality, Kurt, is that this transformation will likely never end, because changing consumer behavior is just going to be status quo going forward, right? The fact that consumer behavior continues to change, the relationship between media and reader continues to change. The things that we are heavily focused on right now, we're still making progress on, is really growing our reach across the globe. We have historically been a Hong Kong newspaper that serves the city of Hong Kong. At times in our history, has served the region, and we're still very, very proud of that. And Hong Kong obviously still matters deeply to us. But going forward, the future of the South China Morning Post is as a global media company that happens to have a specific regional expertise, and that regional expertise is China. So we have to grow outside of our home marketplace. And we have made huge strides in the last 2 years. We are now 80%+, nearly 90% of our audience is outside of Hong Kong. So we are very much a global media company now. But we're still a brand that is relatively new to a lot of our international audience. We still need to build credibility. We still need to build authority. We still need to build relationship with readers that is longer term, that is really about engagement and loyalty. And so that progress is just starting. And there's a lot of effort going into not only brand building, but also making sure that we have the right product, making sure that we have the right experiential relationship with our audience, making sure that even just our actual physical presence, whether it is our bureaus or our executives in some of these new marketplaces, that presence is understood and it actually adds value to the conversation. So that is one area that we're still progressing in. On the product and technology side, again, we're also very, very young in our understanding of what editorial and content product looks like for the future. So yes, we have rebuilt a huge chunk of our data infrastructure, and the way that we build editorial product from a technology point of view is also night and day versus 2 years ago. But we're still just touching the tip of the spear. There's still so much more we have to do. Our entree into using data and artificial intelligence to make our product better for users, again, we're early, early on. We're still discovering new distribution channels. We're still discovering new consumption platforms and new formats. And so I think the editorial product over the next few years, my hope is that we will experiment a lot, we will innovate and invent a lot of new editorial product that actually makes the telling of news story more compelling and the consumption of news story more enjoyable for our readers.
I recall you have mentioned your role when you see the product, is when you see the duty of your role here in the Post is the product problem, you're solving a product problem. And given your previous tech background, I think you're definitely, your strength would be on the online presence and how to grow the growth hacking of the post. But how do you see the print media side of the business?
I care deeply about the print side of our business. I'm a total print head. So I start off every single morning with multiple different print newspapers. We're actually sitting at a table with multiple print newspapers on it every single morning. You work for Monocle. Monocle is one of the great print products that exists in our business today, and it happens to be a relatively new print product. There is a role to play for print, and this role is not going to disappear in a couple of years. I believe that it'll be long term. Print is a product. It is one of many that a media company like ours needs to invest in. But we have to understand that it serves a specific audience for a very specific need. So when I say that part of the solution to the quagmire that the media business is in today is having much more of a user-first product mindset, I'm not just talking about online. I'm not just talking about figuring out digital distribution and how to leverage social media networks and play with new cutting-edge technologies. I'm literally talking about understanding product. And print is a product. The need that we serve with print is no longer about breaking news. Because in the morning when you pick up the print newspaper, most of the news that is in the print newspaper, you've already read the day before. You've already gotten countless alerts on your phone. But there's an experience to reading print that allows you to go deeper into analysis and understanding. There is an expression of opinion on print that just feels heftier, like if the opinions come with more weight. Right? And there is an enjoyment to a print experience, especially on weekends, that make the product just very different than what we can produce on a 6-inch screen that fits into your pocket. So as we're thinking about the future of the South China Morning Post's print edition, we're thinking about those use cases, those advantages, and we have to design the print product to fit those needs. Monocle, and I'm not pandering here, has done that better than most, is understanding the user behavior of why somebody would pick up a thick magazine and stick it in their bag on a long haul flight. And the product itself is designed from cover all the way through to serve that need. Newspapers have to do the exact same thing. And I do think that you're going to see an evolution in what the print newspaper product looks like and the need, the user need or the reader need that it serves in the next few years.
That was Gary Liu from the South China Morning Post in conversation with Monocle's Kurt Lin in Hong Kong. Next on the stack, we turn to the world of books. Some Such Stories is an annual literary publication that sits somewhere between a book and a zine. Founded by LA and London-based creative studio Some Such, it's a series of essays and short pieces of fiction by a handful of really great writers, based around a particular theme each issue. The fourth edition focuses in on redemption. To find out why they chose this topic, Monocle's Holly Fisher spoke with Some Such Stories editor, Suze Olbrick.
With all of the issues, I try to think of a theme or a concept to build ideas around that will sort of be atemporal, or at least will still be really intriguing to people about 6 months down the line, because the whole commissioning through distribution process is sort of about 9 months each time. And so it's sort of a case of like trying to read the augurs of culture, of newsprint, of magazines, of discussions. And there are a couple of things that were going on. Obviously, there was Me Too, and people were talking about whether certain sexual transgressions are irredeemable or not. There was, at the time, Trump was rolling back on DACA and also locking up children on the border with Mexico. So, and also, there was a lot of discussion on certain podcasts I was listening to about shame having been abandoned. Like, there is no public atonement. Like, nothing that man can do is shameful enough that he will need redemption in the eyes of certain voters looking at the midterms. And at the same time, I've sort of been bugged by endlessly the sort of co-option of spiritual terms and the commodification of spirituality by commerce. So even round the corner from here, there's a cafe, I think, that I remember I went to. And it's part of wellness and it's holistic, but when they're selling you dishes which are called salvation or redemption. And I mean, I walked past Gym Box the other day and they've got an A board outside which is like, you know, salvation. I didn't know it was a gym box. I just thought, oh, that's like some Christian church thing. And it's not, it's trying to flog you gym classes. But that's sort of this stealth moralization of commercial activity has been happening for a while. And, you know, like Goop selling crystals. And I think these things can bring people a lot of peace and be points for reflection. I don't think they're useless, but as a mass development, I found it unsettling. And I guess it's good when there's unsettling things or things that are causing you discomfort to try and push in and work out why. And at the same time, I think just when I was forming, the BBC announced that globally, apart from in the UK and maybe just UK and America, then religion's on the upswing everywhere else in the world. So I just thought that was a good sort of pull to start with. And then I sent out some ridiculous brief looking at trying to give the writers as many prompts around that theme as possible. So whether, you know, AI was being proved to be inherently racist and biased on gender, and whether that's too late. And just there are a lot of things that can we redeem ourselves in the eyes of the environmental movements? Probably. I mean, some people say, yes, it's too late to save anything, and some people say no. But anyway, I was trying to build a world for it that would be really rich for writers to then work on.
Can you just, but that's the great thing about these publications, is that you do manage to create this really rich world that's full of fiction, non-fiction, and like you were just saying, you've got a story about gender and AI in this, you've got stories about people saving themselves from themselves, you've got stories about addiction, stories about sex. You cover a lot of ground. When you send out that brief, you say you send out like a very detailed brief trying to create this world. Do you still get a lot of pitches back that really surprise you in the way that they want to take your theme?
Yeah, and that's the most amazing thing about it. It's so collaborative and it's such an exchange. And one or two points will be on it, but where people take, you know, the richness that comes from these writers then thinking on this and coming back with these like extraordinary ideas. And sometimes they're just so, they really do surprise me. Like, say, like Luke Turner's essay on cruising grounds. Like, I never would have thought about that behaviour as sort of looking for redemption under trees, and whether that's sexual liberation or that's causing harm. And if I'm looking at some of the fictional aspects of it, like Sophie McIntosh's short story, which is about manifestation and bad romance and recovery from illness, again, it's like they're just quite wonderfully creative. And especially I think the opening essay, which is by Daisy Johnson, which is actually there's short fiction through the essay. She came back originally with two ideas, one about an essay about the future of writing and creating space for this sort of feminine literature. She quotes somebody, I think it's Helen Sisu in it, but then also said, well, if, you know, I've written a novel about retelling, so if I'm going to do a retelling for this, looking at redemption of characters, then we've got to start at the beginning with Eve. And then it was sort of like, well, both of these are really great. So as an editor, it's like, well, can we see if we can work out a way that they can be developed into one piece? And it turned out beautifully.
So do you have like a notepad in your pocket that you go around and you note down all these different words that could be possible, some such themes, or are you kind of circling things in magazines? When you say you have to like think of these 9 months in advance and you've got a kind of, there's a bit of a clairvoyancy about it, but how do you kind of come up with them?
Some of it is iPhone snaps of silly things that, you know, that you just sort of save them. It's scrolling, most of it is iPhone notes, to be honest. I do have various journals for various things, but I've just found it's just easier because this does take a long time to sort of have. I mean, there's also like endlessly pocketed articles and saved articles. And as soon as you start building a theme, I'll sit with it for about a month anyway and see if it resonates. And if you see more and more people picking up on different aspects of it, like comment pieces and things, and you sort of know you're on the right track. So that's sort of how the picture's built. Sometimes you walk into a gallery and you'll just see, you know, an artist's interpretation of something and it's perfect, or a tweet, and it comes from everywhere basically.
So you're kind of looking for something that's already bubbling under and you want to kind of expand that world a bit.
Yeah, I guess it's asking questions. You want things that people are curious about. And I think a lot of people in Western societies, it's been discussed that we sort of lack a framework for morality within atheist societies. When people are suffering, or say there's things go wrong, then it's quite hard to, if you don't have a faith, I guess, or, you know, if people aren't so into yoga that they're also getting the spiritual element of it rather than just the exercise, and you sort of flail around. And I guess it's sort of, it seemed like certain of these ideas are things that will have thrown people, like our last issue is about disorientation. I know that was felt by pretty much everyone looking at what was happening in 2016, 2017. Whereas now I think people are looking for ways to move forward. And it can be very helpful to have a sort of spiritual or other framework to work within that. But if you're atheist and subsumed in our sort of commercial capitalist culture.
And the cover, I mean, it's a very, very vibrant cover that you've gone for, a kind of hot neon pink and a bright green as well. Who designs your covers for you? Is it the same artist each time?
Yeah, we've been working with Fraser Muggeridge Studio, this incredible graphic designer. And so I gave him an extra ring to get some more background on this yesterday, because it's such a striking design. It was the first one he proposed. And when we were talking about it, I mean, so Some Such Stories is funded by Some Such, as a publishing arm of Some Such, who are sort of internationally acclaimed makers of adverts and documentaries and films and content. And this image, the basis of it, is a screen ratio graphic. So he said he just had it for a long time and sort of things I like. But actually what struck him about it was that it was positive and it looked almost like a temple, or it could be, it reads into, I mean, I've had people tell me it looks like a cake. Yeah. I think it could look like a Masonic lodge or something. I mean, there's something religious about it, and there's something about the structure that is read in different ways. You know, it just kind of resonates. I like that it's different blocks, because in that way of, you know, the writing all feeds into each other, but nothing's fully, you know, attached. Anyway, what Fraser liked is, what his words were, that you cannot ever faithfully represent, you know, a book in one image, you're going to fail. So you want something that's a little bit ambiguous but striking and open to many different interpretations. And it just works so well that straight away, I mean, myself and Sally and Tim, who are in the company, were sort of straight away like, yes, this is it. And I do like that people also think it's a wedding cake or whatever else, or a stack of presents. That's it, festive.
People
very
Christmas
commercial
on the brain,
exactly.
Yeah.
That was Suze Ulbrich from Some Such Stories, talking to Monocle's Holly Fisher. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Next up, we head to Brazil to speak to one of the country's most recognisable figures in media, Marcelo Tass. Creator of the character Ernesto Varela, a fictitious reporter, Tass has been part of the media scene in the country for years now, including as host of satirical political programme CQC. Now, Marcelo is a host at one of the country's largest radio stations as well, CBN. Tass spoke to Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco in São Paulo about the state of Brazilian print.
I'm a big fan of printed media since I was a child. You know, I'm used to it. You know, I have three sons and they don't care about printed media. You know, when I travel, I see the paper, they don't touch the paper. Even my wife, my wife likes it, but not as much as me. But what is going on with printed media in Brazil, I think is something that is going on all over the world. They spend too much time without noticing the revolution, the digital revolution, or noticing and they don't care about it. And I think this has to do a lot with arrogance. When you have power, you can become blind about some stuff that is going on around you. And I think that this happened, unfortunately, a lot here in Brazil. For instance, the largest magazine, the publisher of magazines in Brazil, Editor Abril, it's almost at the end right now. And 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it was, you know, an empire. They thought they were, you know, so powerful they could stay away from this, you know. And what I'm talking is not about ignorance only. I'm talking about when you have power, you have difficulty to listen. That's the point. And we are living now on an era of listening, as you guys are listening to us right now. We are living on this era. And when you don't want to listen in the way that you are listening right now, I mean, when people want to push you things. No, you're going to listen this way. I'm going to send you the news only in the morning or in at night or once a week. You know, that is the main point of the digital revolution. We don't want to be pushed anymore, you know. And the networks, the television networks, they still use even the word emission. We have emissions. People don't want only emissions. They want to take care of the emissions their way, you know. That's the revolution for me, is the revolution of choice and the revolution of listening.
Do you think, are there any newspapers and magazines that are doing an okay job here in Brazil?
Some of the papers decide at the last minute to move. And I like what is going on now at Folha de São Paulo. They, you know, it is the newspaper that I read every day. And I think finally they decide to invest, you know, solid on this change and in video. I don't know if they will have time, you know, for the transition. But I respect a lot the work that they are doing there. But very good newspaper missed the pace, like o Estado de São Paulo, even o Globo, which is a great newspaper from Rio, and which is inside the organizations of Globo TV, but is very poor on video, for instance, or on internet. You know, it's very close, it's still very close platform, you know. And so in the world, I think we have a good experiences going on. We have the New York Times leading, in my opinion, this change. They start to move, you know, since the early beginning. I love the Financial Times. I'm a subscriber of this paper. I like how they balance content and, you know, the new media, even though if I can say some words about the Financial Times, I think they are already they lack a lot of resources producing videos, because they are trying to produce videos like television, which is not a good idea, because if you are not a television, if you don't have the foundations of a television, you make poor television, as I think, with all respect, Financial Times is doing. You know, when they go to an event, they produce a video, and it seems to me like a poor made television spot about that event. They can do more, I'm sure, because they have what is important on this era, which is good quality content. You know, they produce a wonderful content. So it's only a way everybody now, we have to understand how we can, again, we have to understand how language, how communication is being changed through all these tools. And for me, the best sign if you are doing a good communication is to listening to the result. Because we have to understand that communication is not what I'm saying right now on this microphone, is what you on the other side is listening.
That was Marcelo Tass talking to the Stack's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco in São Paulo a little earlier. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments, queries or suggestions are welcome. Drop a note to Fernando at fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next week. But before we go, as something of a public service, we have a song tip to animate those potentially tedious end-of-year parties. This is Wolfram featuring Paul Parker with Out of Control. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.